Welcome to In the Moment. Lori Walsh is off. I'm Steve Zwemke. Heated conversations and confrontations don't seem to be going away anytime soon, but a new book aims to help. De-escalate: How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less is the title of Douglas E. Knoll's latest book. Knoll is a trial lawyer turned mediator from California. Knoll describes himself as a full-time mediator and peacemaker, a radio talk show host, speaker, author, teacher, trainer, business consultant, and facilitator. He is typically engaged in cases where emotions are high, communication is poor, and the conflict is deep. Knoll joined Prairie Public's Doug Hamilton on Monday. Douglas E. Knoll is the author of a soon-to-be-released book titled De-escalate: How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. He joins us by phone. Good to have you with us, Doug.
Thanks, Doug. Great to be here.
Well, it's always fun to talk to another Doug as well.
That's right.
You started out as an attorney. When did you decide to, move away from legal practice and focus on mediation issues?
Well, I started my career as a trial lawyer in 1977 when I passed the California bar, and I clerked for a year for a judge and then went into private practice with a firm, and they groomed me as a trial lawyer, and I joined the firm in September of 1977 and tried my first jury trial in November of 1978, 2 months after I joined the firm. And after that, it was just try cases like crazy, mostly business and commercial cases. Along the way, I started studying the martial arts. And after I earned my second degree black belt, my teacher told me that I had to go learn Tai Chi. Well, the interesting thing about Tai Chi is, one, it's the oldest of all martial arts. And two, it has two paradoxes. One is, the softer you are, the stronger you are. And the other paradox is, the more vulnerable you are, the more powerful you are. Soft to be strong, vulnerable to be powerful. Well, in the beginning, this just did not compute. Secondary black belt, hardcore trial lawyer, I'm a big guy, 6'1", 200 pounds. I mean, it just didn't work. But over the years, as I studied it, it seeped into me, until one day I was in the courtroom and I was cross-examining somebody, and the thought came to me, what the heck am I doing in here? And after that trial, I took off on a long river trip up in northern Idaho and spent the week powering through big rapids in my raft and thinking about all of this, and came back deciding that maybe there had to be a better way for me to serve people other than being a trial lawyer. And it turned out that when I came back into town — I live in the central Sierra Nevada — I was driving down into Fresno where my office was, and there was a public service announcement on our local public radio station for a new master's degree program in peacemaking and conflict studies. This was in 1998. And I listened to it, and it kind of caught my attention. And so I went to the university, which was Fresno Pacific University, which is the West Coast Mennonite University. And ultimately, I enrolled and was trained by the Mennonites to become a peacemaker. And I'm not a Mennonite myself, but it blew me away. What I saw was missing from my legal practice in terms of how we have to deal with human conflict. And so that led me to leaving the law firm and my law practice in 2000 and opening up a peacemaking and mediation practice. And since that time, I have helped thousands of people resolve deep, serious, and intractable conflicts all around the world, with all kinds of different problems. And I teach and train. And in 2010, with my colleague Laurel Coffer, got the opportunity to begin training murderers to be peacemakers in California maximum security prisons. And so I've been doing that along with my professional practice. And over the years, inmates kept coming up to me and saying, if I had learned these skills 20 years ago, I wouldn't be in prison right now. So that's when my 50-watt light bulb went on in my dim head. And I thought, well, maybe there's a book here. Maybe I should make the stuff that I'm practicing and teaching available to everybody. And so that's what led to the book De-escalate, which is coming out in 2 weeks. And the idea here is that we can de-escalate any angry person, child, 2-year-old to 90-year-old person, in less than 90 seconds if we just do 3 things. And the first thing is, we ignore the words. Doesn't matter what they're screaming at you, just ignore it. In this moment, for 90 seconds, you don't pay any attention to what they're saying. The second thing you do is guess at what they're feeling. What are they feeling right now? And then the third step, which is the most important and the most counterintuitive, is that you state back, you reflect back their emotions to them in a very simple you statement. You're angry, you're frustrated, you don't feel like you're being supported, you feel like you've been treated unfairly, you're sad, you feel unloved, you feel abandoned, whatever it might be. And you just simply repeat back those emotions. And when you do that, actually what's happening in the brain, this is all based on some neuroscience done by Matthew Lieberman at UCLA. What happens is you're literally lending your prefrontal cortex to the person who's upset in that moment so that that person can process his or her emotional experience in a way that she otherwise can't do. Because when we become highly emotional, our ability to think and to reason goes out the window, as we all know.
So to be an effective mediator, you really have to understand behavioral science. You have to
I mean, I'm a student of neuroscience, and because all conflict starts in the brain, right? And peace starts in the brain, too. So what goes on in our brains is what we as mediators and peacemakers have to work with. And it turns out that a lot of stuff around active listening and all the stuff that's been taught all these years is mostly wrong. It's not based on good science. It's not based on any science at all. It's based on myth. So these techniques that I've developed are based on brain scanning studies where neuroscientists have actually watched these emotional centers of brains calm down when somebody engages in this process known as affect labeling, or basically stating back emotions. So I stumbled onto this technique by accident in a mediation in 2004, read the study in 2007 that explained and validated what I had been practicing and learning, and then we decided to test it out and acid test it in maximum security prisons starting in 2010. And it works. It works every time without failure.
Well,
it's amazing.
Let's just contrast these two disciplines, if you will. The law profession, you've got
right.
precedents and you've got, facts and things like that to kind of keep in order. Here, you're listening and reflecting, but the goal of both of these professions is to get to an outcome. So,
but what outcome? And that, I think that's the critical question.
So the mediated outcome is not necessarily one you walk into the mediation with?
That's correct. I mean, you come into a mediation let's just call it a mediation. You can walk into a mediation, which might be a negotiation over a civil lawsuit, or it might be something else entirely. And oftentimes people will come into a mediation with a certain set of positions or ideas of what they think they want, but a really skilled mediator will guide the parties through a process, and they all of a sudden discover this isn't what this fight is about at all. And they come out with agreements that they never expected to make. That happens all the time. So the difference between the judicial system and the peacemaking process, especially the kind of non-litigated peacemaking process that I mostly do in family business conflicts and partnership disputes and things like that, is that you go to a court to get a decision. And the assumption is that if a decision is rendered and basically follows the rule of law, that people will, on the whole, accept that decision even though they lose. But it's a decision-making process in which the parties have no power. The power to decide is all vested in either a judge or a jury. In the mediation process, it's exactly the opposite. The parties have the power to decide how, when, and what's going to constitute a resolution of their problem. And the mediator is like a Sherpa, guiding them up the mountain towards a resolution, but not actually making the decisions for them.
And the most important skill here is listening, I take it.
The foundational, there are many, many skills involved in mediation as a mediator, but the foundational skill is knowing how to listen and de-escalate and know what to listen for. Because when people are highly emotional, as they always are in deep and intractable conflicts, they can't problem solve. You cannot problem solve with somebody who's really angry. You have to calm that person down, whether it's a two-year-old having a tantrum or a business executive. If that person is highly emotional, very angry, for example, that you can't persuade, you can't talk, you can't reason, you can't do anything with them. You have to de-escalate before you can problem solve. And so that's what led me to develop these skills, because I realized as a mediator that unless I could get people calmed down, I couldn't help them solve their problems. And they couldn't make good decisions. So calming people down becomes the foundational skill. And it turns out that this skill is universal. It works everywhere. It works in families. It works with kids. It works with teachers and students. I've taught middle school teachers how to do this, and high school teachers. I've taught mediators and judges and lawyers. And I've been consultants to families and taught families how to do this. It is universally applicable to every human interaction.
I came across a blurb that was about you, and I'm just going to read back this sentence about you. His particular interest is in deep, intractable conflicts where emotions are running high.
Right.
Why?
Well, why am I interested in that, or
yes.
Why does that happen?
No, why are you interested in it?
Because those are the most difficult conflicts. They're the most challenging. And that's where the most good can be done. Because what happens if people who are in deep, intractable conflicts and are highly emotional can find a way to make peace with each other rather than shooting each other with AK-47s, they grow from that experience. And they realize that it feels a lot better to get to resolution than it does to continue fighting. And two, there's a moral growth that occurs when people actually take personal responsibility for their decisions and for their actions and actually are able to reach across the table when hours before all they wanted to do is knife the other guy. And when I watch that happen, it just gives me tremendous satisfaction to know that I've served these people in a very deep and profound way that I could have never experienced as a trial lawyer.
Well, if this is the practice of empathy here we're talking about?
Absolutely. You know, the difference between empathy and sympathy is in sympathy we can recognize that somebody's in distress, but we don't necessarily feel the same the distress that the other person feels. In empathy, we are able to experience the distress sufficiently to be able to, if we're affect labeling, for example, to be able to affect label it back and help that person in distress get relief from that strong emotion, whatever it might be. So it is very much an empathic skill. In fact, it is probably the ultimate empathic skill.
You mentioned affect label. What is that?
Affect labeling is a technical term. Affect is the you could call it the scientific term that encompasses the idea of feelings and emotions that we experience. And affect technically is the mechanisms in the brain that are stimulated and ignite and become active when there are either outside stimuli that we pick up with our five senses or are stimulated by memories or both that activate to make us pay attention to what's going on. And depending upon which theory you follow, there's some controversy around this. There are either four or five or nine affects. And I happen to follow the nine affect theory of Sylvan Tompkins, but they're just theories. And what Tompkins did, this is back in the 60s, is he watched babies. And he saw that infants who don't have emotions yet, their emotional centers haven't matured yet, are born with nine different physiological and responses that show things like disgust and rage, excitement, startle, all these different things that are hardwired into our brains. And it's the combination of these nine different affects coupled with experience and growing and being in a social environment that teaches us what emotions are. Emotions are a cognitive construct, it's both cognitive and biological. Emotions are made up of affect and also made up of a cognitive part. We build a database literally as we grow from babies to infants to toddlers. We're building this database of what anger means or what love means. We're not born with that. We have to learn it. And we learn it in conjunction to our physical feelings, what's going on in our brain, and what we experience in the environment around us.
Doug Knoll is the author of Deescalate, How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. It's coming out in September. Doug, you argue that people who negotiate remedies for significant conflicts, like, you know, Middle East peace, that kind of thing,
right,
generally lack appropriate mediation skills, which ends up causing poor policy.
That's correct. My experience, that was my third book, was called Elusive Peace, and I was really critiquing the international diplomatic community's efforts to make peace around the world. And I studied dozens and dozens of peacemaking efforts, peace processes, and every single one, I found that the peacemaker, the mediator, was usually some named diplomat who had risen through the ranks of the UN or some international organization or was a former political leader in a country. Was called in because he, almost never a she, called in because he had a reputation, but had absolutely no skills in how to de-escalate, how to negotiate, how to figure out how to help people solve these really deep, difficult problems. And that's why we have a huge failure rate, in my opinion, in international conflict resolution. The UN has a success rate of about 8%. As a professional mediator, I have a success rate of about 93%. If I had a success rate of 8% as a professional mediator, I'd be out of business. Now, people can say, well, the conflicts are a lot more difficult. And yes, they are. They can be much more difficult. However, the human brain responds to conflict in exactly the same way, no matter what the conflict is. And my argument was and is that international diplomats need to be trained in these things, and they're not. And that's why we continue to have failures of peace processes.
The 10th chapter of your new book, Deescalate, How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less, is headed, How to Be Civil in an Uncivil Society. Well, that's a current event we're talking about here. So
that's right.
Give us a lesson.
Sure. So let's suppose that you're at the table or you're having a weekend. Here we are at the late August, end of the summer, in a politically chaotic time. And you happen to be sitting with a relative or a friend or a neighbor who has politically opposite views, radically opposite views than you. How do you go about having a civil conversation with that person without avoiding the elephant on the table and without getting just totally frustrated and angry? And the rules are really simple. First, forget persuading. Forget persuasion. Forget argument. Forget trying to be right. Forget trying to get yourself validated or your ideas validated by this other person. It's not going to happen. So just, you've got to be in a place where you don't need to be validated. Then what you do is, if the person starts to get worked up, you de-escalate or you're angry, you're frustrated, whatever it might be. As they calm down, you start asking questions like, gee, you know, what is it in your life experience that led you to have the beliefs that you have today? And what you're asking them to do is not talk about their beliefs, but sort of reflect on, well, why is it that I believe what I believe today, and what is it that led me to my beliefs? And by starting to talk about and exchange life experiences, you start to realize that, hey, we have a lot in common, and maybe we see things differently, but we've had very common experiences, and maybe we're not as far apart as we think we are. And then you might ask a question like, well, how do you reflect your beliefs in your everyday life? How do these show up in your everyday life and the kind of decisions you make and the kind of things you do and what you do? How does it show up? People are never asked these questions. They're never asked to think about this and talk about it. And when you ask somebody who's politically polarized from you about this, they are in deep gratitude that there's somebody who's really willing to listen to them and help them kind of think about this stuff. And so you can just continue on in the same vein. Well, how do you deal with people who have different belief structures than you do? What do you do with them? What are you doing if you're working and you've got somebody who's just radically different than you are? How do you manage that? And you notice that in all these questions, we're never talking about their beliefs, never challenging their beliefs, just talking about how they live their beliefs, how they came to their beliefs, how their beliefs affect their lives.
It sounds like a conversation.
It's a conversation. But what happens is, since we have lost the ability to do this, we tend to get very defensive. Somebody says something very provocative that challenges our belief structure, and we take it as a personal insult and disrespect, and now we have to defend ourselves, and so now we get into argument mode. You're right. You're wrong. I'm right. Listen to me. And there's no longer a conversation. It's a fight.
Our social media behaviors have started to interfere with our regular behaviors, it sounds like.
Well, there's a certain amount of truth to that. It's funny how the younger people just are unable to pick up the phone and call somebody, or they're unable to say, let's meet for coffee and talk about this. It's as if they've stunted themselves in terms of social interaction and their ability to listen and to gain information and to be comfortable around strong emotions. Very interesting, which is another reason why the book is so important.
Douglas E. Knoll is the author of Deescalate, How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. That book is coming out in a couple of weeks. You also have a website, more than one actually, but DougKnoll.com, Knoll.com is one place people can go.
And let me just say very quickly that there's a philanthropist who is backing the book. The book is being published by Simon & Schuster, Beyond Words, Simon & Schuster. But there's a philanthropist who is very interested in seeing as many people as possible read this book. So if you go to the website, DougKnoll.com, click on the banner, you can get the book free plus shipping.
All right. Or you
can
right.
go to any of the usual places, and the price is right. We want everybody to read and practice these tools.
Author and mediator Douglas Knoll visited with Prairie Public's Doug Hamilton on Monday. Again, Knoll's latest book is called De-escalate: How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less.